everybody. Welcome to this week's Q&R. I am Megan, and today I have with me the teaching team, Pastor Adam, Pastor Wayne, and this is Pastor Cam Wright. He is a pastor at Faith United Methodist Church, and he is a part of the teaching team here at Broadway. So welcome, guys.
Thank you.
We are so glad that they are here with us today. Just a couple reminders as we sort of talk about every week when we get started. As you can tell, we have no computers up here, so we can't see what you're writing in the comments. But Pastor Lou, this week again, is with you in the comments. So you can drop a comment, tell him you're here. If you have some questions, he can answer those. But if it's a question for us, we won't be able to see it until after it's over. So we will come back and address those next week. If you don't necessarily want to write your question in the comments, maybe I don't blame you, depends on what it is, feel free to email me at questions@broadwayunited.org, and we will have it on here next week as well. And so I think to kick us off, Pastor Adam's going to share with us again a little bit about what this is.
Right. Thanks so much for being here. We are really thinking of this time as something different that kind of doesn't exist other places in our world, like a place that's safe to ask questions. The way we sort of frame it is dialogue versus debate. I'm not here to try to convince Wayne or Cam that they're wrong, even when they are, and vice versa. So we're giving responses to questions that people ask, or the questions that we're reading as we're thinking of as we read through the scripture and the chronological Bible reading plan, so from the sermon or from the Bible or from just life in general, so that we can talk about things. And the goal would be that we would just not come from an emotional place to always talk about things that are sometimes difficult or controversial or hard. So I'm pretty excited about that. It's been fun. It kind of takes some of the pressure off. And it's a vision we have for what the church ought to be so that we can love each other, even with people who don't agree on some things or a lot of things. Yeah. So that makes it pretty great. And then to sort of take the pressure off us, we aren't the answer people. So some of what we say is really, you know, like informed. And some of it's like not, you know, some of it's like we're wrestling just as much, you know, like we're reading through Leviticus and it's like, whoo, man, there's a lot that you just kind of got to get through and then try to make sense of. We're going to do some of that today.
All right. Well, I'll start us off with our first question. In Exodus and Leviticus, everyone is supposed to sacrifice their personal animals, grains, money, etc. as the various offerings. Do they have actual money? Do they have a socioeconomic structure? Is there this class system like we have, the upper, middle, lower? You know, is it based on their talents, abilities, their tribe? Like, how does that, what do you all think about that?
Well, at this point in the story, they're still nomadic, and so they're traveling around, and they're not really settled. So I don't really think that they had printed money or coins necessarily. There is a reference to the temple shekel, so there is some way of measuring the value of gold and silver and bronze that they use in building the temple. But I think for the most part, it is barter system, and the way it's set up is that there would not be any economic classes, or if there are, that doesn't really make that much difference. There's nothing in the law or in those books that says those who have more cows are better people than those who have fewer cows.
Right.
There's nothing in there that indicates that. And it's set up so that the poor are cared for, so that those who fall into misfortune, widows and orphans, are cared for.
Foreigners
have a place. And then there's the year of Jubilee where everything resets. And so there's a lot done in there to avoid that idea of rich and poor, that one's better than the other, or even that situation comes to pass. So,
but something to add on to that is just the way they would have understood wealth probably would have been more like how many animals you had or how many children you had. So it was less about how much money you had and more about how much land you could cover with sheep.
Yeah.
So, so it's a little different than what we think about. But when you read the Bible, they'll talk about how many donkeys they had, how many sheep they had. So that's probably how they would have envisioned a rich person.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So the gold or the what's ultimately, like, this comes up in the temple in the tabernacle where they're plating things with gold or using that in worship, that came from, some of that at least came from Egypt when they left Egypt and plundered the Egyptians. But wasn't so much for money, like we would think of it, you know, in that way, as much as a part of worship,
right?
For at least part of that.
Yeah.
So we don't think they probably would have had a lot of coins, right?
Right. Yeah. Just in the mechanics of it, I don't think that there were a monetary system. And again, the whole idea is that they are a covenant people. They're all equally invested in this relationship with God.
Right, so that like may Megan lead us to the next question, because there is a sense of prosperity, right, related to how, you know, whether you are right. blessed with sheep or children or, you know, yeah. whatever. So somebody ask a question about
yeah.
that.
Yeah. He said, the question is, in Genesis and Exodus, I never thought about God promising what I consider stuff. So land, animals, heirs, people, to those he blessed and selected to lead. Is this prosperity theology?
I think the short answer is no, in the way that when somebody asks about prosperity theology, or sometimes it's called prosperity gospel, there's a sort of a new American way of thinking about these things that come up in the last, you know, what, 50 or 100 years. And a lot of people on TV preachers kind of put this out, is the idea that you're going to be blessed, and then that has a lot to do with monetary blessing, and it's really sort of embraced. That's almost like the central part of their theology, is that monetary blessing comes as a part of God's blessing, right. or prosperity comes as a part of God's blessing, which I think there's a component of that in the Bible, but it's not the central thing. And then I'm actually reading a book right now that I would really recommend by Kate Bowler. Cam's reading it too. Mm-hmm. I think Wayne might be as well. Just put out a book. Are you reading it as well? No. Okay. Well, I'm listening to it, so that's, I count. But Kate Bowler is a professor at Duke, where Cam is from, so half the people are no longer
listening. You don't have to out me as a Duke.
But she studied prosperity gospel, and then at 35 was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. And so it's just this weird kind of combination of events in her life or realities in her life, and she just speaks to that kind of back and forth. And it's just a really honest, if you've got that kind of life or death thing going on, it's a really great book. But she kind of refers to people, having studied them sort of academically, who believe that. I mean, they're claiming monetary blessing as their right in a lot of ways. And I just don't think the Bible's saying that. I don't think it promises that. I mean, Paul would later say, you know, I have all things, I have nothing. I think the Bible's more like that. There's just no guarantee. And sometimes we're looking to that prosperity thing for some kind of control over our lives that are out of control, which is, I think, a big theme in the Bible. And I don't think the Bible offers that either. So that name it and claim it is one of a phrase, you know, from that thing, from the prosperity gospel, name it and claim it.
Right.
And it begins really with, I'm going to shut up here in a second. It begins with my felt need. So I need this. I'm going to talk to God about this. And the way the Bible is built is just the opposite. Like, it begins with God's covenant. I'm going to bless you to be a blessing, but that's God's deal, not my deal. And it's so easy in the prosperity gospel. What there might be a kernel of truth to is that God does take care of us, and that right living leads to a lot of good things and blessings. But that doesn't start with me. It starts with God's bigger agenda. And in the prosperity gospel, that can get lost, I think, pretty easy.
Yeah, I think so. You said something
about that. I think something about the prosperity gospel that gets it wrong, and you kind of just said this, but it's important to see that God's promise comes first. And you were talking about that, but that God's covenant begins everything in the Bible. So every story begins with God's promise to us, and they don't have to do anything to receive it. Mm. And so then you respond to that by how you live. You respond to that with trusting in God, that God's initial promise will then come true. And so I think that's the best way to read it, because I think when we think about the prosperity gospel, what we're trying to do is say, if we do all the right things, God will then give what we want. So we make God a vending machine, is how I think about it, so we can punch in all the right things, and then we get the little material blessing that we want. But that's not how God works, because God is a person.
Right.
And so if you treated a person like that, they would probably not want to hang out with you. I would think. If every time you're calling, you're saying, hey, I want this from you, I want this from you. But instead, the Bible shows God's blessing first, and then we respond.
Yeah. That's good.
It's a little different.
That's good.
Yeah. I'm not a Duke graduate, But when I think about this idea of if then, I think of the idea of a first date that I've seen in movies. I don't have a lot of experience with this, according to Cam. But this idea that, you know, when a hypothetical person asks someone out, they say, you know, if you'll go out with me, I will take you to the movie and buy your supper. Somehow entice them into spending some time with you. That's kind of, I think, what this may be that God is doing. That I want to bless you, as Cam's saying. I want to spend time with you. I want to be your God. And so, in order for that to happen, you know, I'll entice you into it. It's an if-then, but initiated out of God's love and desire to have a relationship with us. And his willingness to bring to pass what he wants. And so, even though I don't have a lot of experience with that, I think that's kind of the picture that came to me anyway.
So, like, if you take that further, then, like, how long have you and Melinda been married?
38 years.
So, like, you don't have to do that anymore, right? Because,
right.
You don't have to do nice things for her, that's not true.
But. You might should.
It's not what should.
Right. It's not about. Right. It's not about right. that right. anymore. It's about the relationship, right. not about the stuff.
I do those things because I love her, not in order to get her to love me.
God is the prize, right?
Yeah, I think that's
stuff
what he
or no
wants.
Stuff,
right.
And it's not a consolation prize.
Right. Yeah.
It's like the deal, right? That you get to, we get to have a relationship with God.
Yeah.
So how should people read the parts of the Bible where it seems like this is what God's saying? Where it seems like God says, if you do this, you'll be blessed.
Right.
You know, because that's throughout the Bible.
It is kind of...
We see it in Proverbs, you see it in other parts of the Old Testament. How do we read those in the right way?
Right.
I think it's, this is what I want for you. This is my... You know, if you talk about the blessing side, this is my great desire for you, is for you to have this kind of life. And the way you have that is by partnering with me, by participating in this kind of life that I can be part of. This is, obedience is fulfilling God, the desires of his heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you fulfill the desires of my heart, I'll be able to fulfill the desires of my heart, God says, and give you these things, make you this kind of life. And it's far more than the physical blessing. I think that may be where we get hung up, is we think God wants to give us wealth and health. And really what he's after is something much deeper and better than that.
I think God's created a world in which everybody can be blessed.
Right, yeah.
Right, so when we take more than is our share or live in a scarcity mentality that causes us to take at the expense of others, I think that's... That's a real problem.
Yeah. I think we even do that with grace. We kind of hoard it rather than just scattering, believing there's enough for everybody. When God says, you know, I want everyone, I'm not willing that any should be outside of this.
And there are tensions in the Bible, right?
Right, we talked about that.
Yeah. So, like, the wisdom literature has... there's some truth to, if you live in certain ways, that's going to lead to positive outcomes.
Right.
So... Yes, but then there are also parts of the Bible that are honest about you might do everything right and it might not work out at all.
Right.
So if we're looking for a guarantee, if we're looking for a formula, if you're looking for a vending machine, it just doesn't it doesn't work. And if you aren't blessed with material things, that doesn't mean that God doesn't love you or isn't favoring you. And some of the happiest and most spiritual people I've known in my life, and the way I grew up, even poor, but really, really blessed.
Yeah.
You know, have a relationship with God.
We shouldn't be shocked by that.
No, it's not.
But that indicates how we interpret blessing.
Especially, I think, when the central part of our faith is a perfect man who gets crucified.
Yeah.
You know, there's no one who should have, quote unquote, deserved blessing more than Jesus.
Yeah. Wow.
And in our faith, he enters into suffering.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think if we don't make that the first thing, we're probably not going to read the rest of the Bible right.
That's great.
That's good.
You're going to get good comments on that, Cam. That's good stuff.
People are going to like that. They'll ask for you back.
Yeah, everybody likes when Jesus says, I'm on the cross, now come join me.
Yeah.
That's not as popular.
It's not very popular.
No. In reading this week, we read a lot about sacrifices. A lot. So why is this? You know, what's your all's take on sacrifice.
We don't know. Next question.
It's not going to get better.
There's a lot of tough stuff in Leviticus and Numbers, and I think maybe it's helpful to acknowledge that. It's a world that is so different than ours in some ways and alike in others. And if we're trying to figure out how we're supposed to live from Leviticus, I mean, there are some steps that we're going to have to take. And the whole sacrifice world is a part of that. Right. So, one thing that we might say is what it's not. Cam, you might have something to say about what sacrifice isn't.
Right. We've been talking about this because we don't really... I feel like we all feel this is a very hard thing for us to understand. Why is sacrifice necessary? But I think one thing that's really important for us to get our minds around is that what it's not is we're not trying to appease God. God is not angry at us, and then we have to kill something for God to be happy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's a pagan idea.
Right.
That gods are angry at us, so we have to appease them because we don't know what they're going to do. So that's what it's not. So God is not being appeased. God's not demanding us to kill someone, kill something to make him happy. But then when you say it's not that, it comes a little more difficult to then say, what exactly is the purpose of the sacrifice?
Right.
Do you think it helps to and that I thought about this. When we think about the wrath of God, we think about these offerings as sin offerings, but they sacrificed animals in thank offerings and free will offerings as well. It wasn't just the sin offerings.
Wave offerings.
Yeah. Right, yeah. The wave offerings, and God smells the barbecue, and he goes...
That's right.
Right, so it's for all things. It's not just for atonement.
Just peace.
And then another thing that makes sacrifice different in a way from how we do church is that there's very much a way in which their religion is living into and acting, even in the way they worship, by making a sacrifice. That's not, you know, we kind of think of sitting in church and thinking, you know, and using our heads and reading theology and praying the right prayers and all. Like, that's good, but they had this whole other thing going on where it's like you live into it by acting a certain way in the world as an act of worship. Yeah. That's how you live into God's recreating of the world.
Right.
So whether that's for sin or for gratitude or whatever, the sacrifice was a part of living into it.
Yeah. Now, we don't want people to know they had worship without preachers.
Yeah.
That's not an idea we want to make too popular. Wow. But that's what they did. You know, they didn't have theology taught or preaching. They brought their animals and enacted this story. Right.
And I think it's important for us to think about that we sometimes think about this sacrificial system as being barbaric.
Right.
I think when you think about, oh my gosh, they're killing animals. But I think we've talked about this, but they would probably look at what we do as barbaric because they're honoring the life of the animal and then they're eating the animal. So they're saying this is a life that God created. And in the one scene, Aaron and his sons put their hands on the ram's head, and then they kill the ram, and then they'll eat it in celebration to God.
Right.
And they probably look at how we treat animals, and they probably think that was not honoring the life that God has made.
It's really true. So, like chicken nuggets in the shape of dinosaurs.
Yeah, chicken rings. Like,
our kids don't know that was a living thing. Yeah. We forget that was a living thing that died so that we can live. But they knew that. They lived in a in a much more close connection to that. I mean, my experience of that, we raised chickens at our, you know, for about 7 or 8 years, and then we moved into town and we don't do that anymore. We had them for eggs and then we raised them for meat. And I mean, I butchered chickens. And people would say, like, do you enjoy that? And it's like, absolutely not. I don't enjoy it, but I do feel a sense of just it helped me remember that everything that I eat in some way has died so that I can live. And that idea does carry forth to Jesus, that we're living into, he's acting out something in worship for us, and that he died so that we can live. They understood that in a way that I think we don't. Yeah. So when we think of Jesus as a sacrifice, it's not the wrath, you know, of God being appeased as much as it is living into what God's doing, and then that God himself would be the sacrifice flips the whole thing on its head anyway.
Somehow his giving his life creates the possibility of us having life.
Yeah,
and I think that's another way to think about sacrifice, is the sacrifice somehow creates God and humanity to meet each other. Somehow in the sacrifice the two are able to come together in a way that's not possible without it.
Right.
And we don't understand, it's a mystery.
Right.
But somehow that's what a sacrifice does.
And it doesn't happen anywhere. And in the pagan principle, it happened all kinds of places. But for them, it happened in one place. And it was a very important place, which symbolized that very thing. God meeting them, the tent of meeting, or the tabernacle, or eventually the temple. The place where they thought heaven and earth met.
Yeah.
Right.
And so it was really important to take that seriously. And there's a lot of ritual to that.
And so, like, when we do communion, we're remembering that sacrifice, and we believe that we're encountering God in communion in a unique way.
Right.
And that's kind of same kind of idea. We're somehow remembering the sacrifice of Jesus, and we're meeting the Holy Spirit in this celebratory meal. Right.
And we do that not because we can explain it or know what it's going to look like, but because Jesus said, "Do this in remembrance of me." And so he takes responsibility for whatever happens in those moments.
And it is in worship for us, it's one of the moments where people do get up out of their seats and out of just their heads and walk into the story, which is pretty great.
Yeah.
Okay, now is there anything tough
talk about? There's one more tough question and then a little easier one. So we're going to end on a happy note, so I'm going to ask this one next. We talked about sacrificing, but there was also a lot of killing people.
Yeah.
Killing, if you didn't understand me.
Yeah.
But yeah, so what are y'all,
Yeah, guys, what do you think about
that? What do you think about that?
To make sure everybody's clear on what we're talking about, so in Leviticus, there is, so like, you do this wrong. These are the things that are not acceptable. And if you have, if someone commits adultery, for example, then, the message is to go stone them. Or if you're not sure, to have the woman drink bitter water, and if she miscarries, then you know that she had cheated, and if not, I mean, it's just like really, really tough stuff. Like,
pretty harsh.
Harsh. Yeah.
I think the first thing that comes to mind for me is that we're not going to understand this until we really get what holiness means and how seriously they took holiness, as they were a holy people, they were set apart. I don't think we can really totally understand that, but that has to be the context.
It's the starting point, at least.
Yeah, God's saying, this people, you really need to follow these commandments because I'm actually dwelling with you. You know, it's not like I'm up in the sky far away, but God's actually dwelling with them. And something about that had these really harsh regulations. And it's
to set them apart so that they would be different. And some of those things, like, we would say, okay, that carries forth, like, as a universal thing, like, There's a cost to some actions that create negative consequences, and if we want to be God's people, we're going to be set apart and be different than that. And then there are some things that we wonder, does that apply now the same way that it did then? Is that just something to set those people, the God's people, apart from the people around them? So again, there's a sense that there's right and wrong. Okay, so we can hang with that.
Right.
It's just the capital punishment piece of it that, like, I think we should get hung up on.
Yeah. It's a tough question, and we should wrestle with it more than we do, probably.
Yeah.
Just the whole idea of capital punishment in light of who Christ is and what he has done, what he has taught, which is always, where we start, where we finish.
Yeah, so it's okay to read the Bible with a sense that we're looking through Jesus and what he taught.
Yeah.
Even though this came way before Jesus. Right. If we're Christian, we believe that Jesus speaks to what came before him and what came after him. Yeah. And I think any easy sort of explanation of violence or, so it says in the Bible, so then that's just it and we don't have to worry about it, I think is, especially on things like this, is really, really damaging.
Yeah,
it does a lot more evil in the world than wrestling with.
And people say, "Well, then who decides what was for then and what's for now?" And hopefully, the community does. Mm-hmm. That we don't just take that on ourselves, but that we continue to struggle with those questions.
And we have to. Yeah. I mean, the answer is we do. And if we don't, we're relinquishing our God-given responsibility to live in this time.
Yeah.
I would say, so one story I think of with, looking at this through Jesus, I mean, of course, the cross, I think, speaks to all violence and was a defining moment in our understanding of just how wrong it is.
Yeah.
But then Jesus with the woman who was caught in adultery is another story I think of. And, of course, the man isn't brought to Jesus, just the woman, which I think is, a sign of that, of where we get this wrong,
Right.
And so the the act was there, you know, the legalism was, okay, we're going to stone her.
Right.
And Jesus doesn't, and not only does he not enforce that we would go back to Leviticus and say, well, that's the law. And people will say, well, Jesus didn't come to get rid of the law. He even said himself, or he came to fulfill it. But in this moment, he did not do the thing that Leviticus said to do. So, okay, that tells us something. And then not only did he not do it, but he knelt down to her, looked her in the eye, and he said, I don't condemn you. He said, go and sin no more. And sometimes when people tell that story, they'll say, but he did say go and sin no more. And I think he did. But that would totally miss the point of someone totally disrupting all the authority that came into that scene with men bringing this woman, looking her in the eye, and not condemning her. That's what that story is about.
Right.
And I think we got to take that seriously when we think about anything that we read. Especially, I think that story from Jesus is specifically about these Leviticus commands.
I think that even if you go back to the first story in Genesis, where God says, you know, if you eat from this, you will surely die. He can't bring himself to kill them. I mean, we can spiritualize it and say, well, they died spiritually. But I think God was, you know, he just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
He couldn't kill them
because
of that grace and that mercy that Jesus exemplified there with that woman. And so the law is there and is to be taken seriously, but also always in the light of what Jesus taught.
That's good.
And Jesus says he's the fulfillment of the law.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a sense in which the law teaches us the absolute seriousness of our bodies and our lives.
Yeah.
And really that adds such a dignity to human life. Yeah, but Jesus fulfills us and shows us how we can live it out, maybe.
Exactly.
That's good.
That's really good.
Well, and I think we live in a time where people are kind of willing to kill for a lot of reasons, but we follow a Savior who is willing to die.
Yeah.
And that's the switch, right?
Yeah.
Are we willing to kill for something, or are we willing to die for something? I think that's the Christian question. All right, so there's that. Let's before
we know what? I like it. And I'm the one that's sort of asking the questions, and I'm done asking questions. We're going to stop right there. I like ending it on grace.
Yeah.
Right. So that's all we have, folks, today. If you have questions from your reading or from Sunday morning, feel free to email them to questions@broadwayunited.org. You can use your communication sheet on Sunday morning and write it on the back and drop it in the offering. And we hope to have this by Monday at noon. But hey, if you wake up Tuesday morning and you read and you have a question, send it in. Don't not send it in because you think it's too late. It's never too late. So send those questions in, and we will see you right back here next Wednesday at noon on Facebook Live. And I'm going to have another girl on here. Pastor Laura will be joining me, and so I'm super excited about that.
It's going to be so great. Yeah. Sweet.
We'll see you then.
Bye, guys.